Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
An abomination. We're going to talk about an abomination very shortly, and we'll have to explain to you what we're talking about because it is in the media. Welcome to the Media Project from the studios of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady.
Nice to be here again.
It is wonderful to see you. And, of course, the amazing Dr. Alan Chartok.
That's so nice of you to say, because just today, one of the photographers from your paper was here doing a sort of a photo shoot with me.
Hmm.
And I was saying to her, are you sure you're supposed to be here? Because I think Rex has standing orders. No, I'm never going to be in the photo.
I'm sure it was a misunderstanding. There must have been. I think they were going for somebody else. Some other
Lewis,
my
twin brother.
Lewis, right? We're doing a profile of Lewis Chartok. Anyway, this is an opportunity, folks, for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and if you're lucky, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. The aforementioned abomination, as we say, is the comment of Mark Leibovich. Mark Leibovich is the New York Times Magazine national correspondent based in Washington, and he's the author of the book This Town, which a year ago when it first came out in hardback really grabbed Washington by the way that it linked the celebrity culture of D.C. in the media and politics. Anyway, Mark Leibovich says that it is an abomination, the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
And what was his reasons? I mean, what did he seem to think was so abominable about it?
Well, he said, I think that it's morphed into this extravaganza of more than two dozen pre-parties and after-parties, and we have to ask ourselves, what are we celebrating exactly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to agree with him because I think these dinners where the press and the politicians get together and party are a little too close. I think we need a distance. In New York State, we have the same thing with the LCA show. I know this is an unpopular position in Albany, but the Legislative Correspondents Association has this annual show, skit. They put together comedy routines and all the politicians come. And I just think it's a little too close. Down in Washington, they do it. And I think the reporters bring their spouses, their kids, and they get to have their picture taken with the president. And it just seems like that is the laying the foundation for, a favor of sorts. Even though it's not money, it's proximity. Sure, it can help you establish sources, but at the end of the day, I think it's too close.
Oh, by the way, that certainly is a position I've always taken here on the Media Project. And we've been doing this show for a long time, and I've been saying it for a long time. Rex and I have talked about this many times because I think there's something unseemly about reporters and others hawking tickets, which I think they used to do. I don't know if they still do it, to the politicians that they're covering. Now, what politician is going to say, get out of my office, you think you're buying? And this is the kind of thing that reporters have always objected to, these conflicts of interest. And so here's a surefire conflict of interest. So I don't like it. I know for a couple of years, Rex did the right thing, and they didn't take tables at the LCA show here, the Legislative Correspondent Show. But I think you're probably back to it again, aren't you, Rex?
No, actually, I'm getting too much credit and not enough credit, both. which just means to say you're inaccurate. No, it's a...
again.
locally, the Legislative Correspondent Show, which is the oldest show of its kind in the country, began more than 100 years ago on a barge in the middle of the Hudson River, and until the 1960s, or maybe even the 70s, it was only men. And finally, there were women who were admitted to the Legislative Correspondents Association, and then women were allowed to attend the dinner. But it used to be that there was some separate event for the wives while the men got together with cigars and scotch and did this funny show.
So now I hate it even more.
Yeah, for there you go. Even though those who are the stars now are the women who tend to be better singers, of course, than the men.
And better organizers.
Yeah, that too. I was in that show for 16 years back when I was a reporter.
And, because you're, people should know that you're quite a singer, Rex.
Well, I like
and that you are. You're quite a singer. You're in the Albany Pro Musica group. You've distinguished. You're a handsome lad. You're about 6 feet.
Not enough about
graying
me.
At the temples and a star type.
Graying at the temples. Very kind of you to think that it's only at the temples.
Well, that's where it started.
But the you know the basic criticism I think is a valid one, and I don't know any way to get around it except to say that it's a tradition that survives. And in Washington, it's not just the White House Correspondents' Dinner. There's also the Gridiron, and there's the Radio Television News. They've changed the name of it, Radio Television Digital News Association, RTDNA. They also do these fancy dinners. The Gridiron is a white tie, in fact. I've been to
so
that
now,
a couple
so
times.
Now we are faced with not only the Academy Awards and the Emmys and the Oscars, now they have red carpets outside this thing. And not only that, but the politicians all know that they're all so self-effacing. Obama came on, the president came on, and he did his own self-effacing thing about Obamacare and the rest. And they have, obviously, people working on this thing full-time, getting these things ready. Because in the old days, you didn't get to know what was said. It was allegedly all off the record. Now it's on the record, and it's big stuff.
So let me just double-check, Alan, if...
Was that wrong again?
No, no. Oh. If you got a phone call from... Let's just say from the New York Times Washington bureau chief and said, Alan, I really think I'd like for you to be my guest at the White House Correspondents' Dinner this year. Wouldn't you like to come and see the president and meet all these people? It'd be very interesting.
Yeah. I have had such invitations. Back in the day, I accepted it, I think twice twice way, way long ago from a person whose name I will not mention on the radio, so you could pretty well figure out who it is who works for one of those newspapers, and went. And I decided I just was so uncomfortable that I didn't want to do it again. And while I've been invited since...
No, I'm not talking about Albany. I said the White House correspondents there.
I would absolutely say no. You are looking
really?
At, yeah. You're looking at a guy who was offered by a congressman the one ticket he was given to the State of the Union address. Each of those congressmen get a ticket and asked me if I would... take the ticket if I wanted the ticket.
And why did you say no?
I don't like to travel.
Well, that's a different
I like my own bed, you know? I don't like to go anywhere.
You know, I was expecting this principled speech, and I don't like to travel.
I could have done that. Okay, let's try it again. I didn't go because... No.
You and Mario both...
But the other part of this is that it is insular, that they get contained in this room, in this city, and they don't look outside their world, and that... at the end of the day, can influence what they write or how we shape the message that we give the public about what's happening in government.
Leibovich, who we started this with, calling WHCD an abomination, Leibovich of the Times says, this is a classic case of the bubble world and the unself-awareness of spending however millions of dollars over a number of days to celebrate ourselves. And again, I ask why, he says. So. Yeah. The bubble world, that is, I think, really the danger of this thing, because you begin to see yourself as part of the world that is reporters and players all being of the same world. And one of the dangers that we confront, actually, even in hiring, is that as journalism has become a more respected profession in a certain way, as it's been more professionalized, we have fewer people who are really kind of outsiders in the newsroom. We have fewer people with a strong blue-collar background, people who bring the voice of a lot of our traditional readers into our pages or onto our airwaves and become more like the politicians they cover.
So who should they be? I mean, that's a very interesting topic. And I'm wondering, I mean, you obviously have to hire people who are trained journalists and are accomplished journalists or photographers, right? So in order to get somebody with a blue-collar background, would they be a journalist who is the son or daughter of a blue-collar person. And I know we've been talking about this on the show for many years in terms of background. Are you black? Are you Chinese? Are you, you know, Hispanic? And that's important. But also this the business of professional journalistic training versus the kind of voice you want.
Yeah, talk about that, Judy. How do you figure this out?
You know, and it's more than background as well, but you have enough opportunities now. Like nowadays, things are starting to improve in the newspaper business. We're starting to hire more, so you're starting to see candidates and get a chance to bring new people into the newsroom. But it is so important to have different perspectives, and it can come from any part of their lives, whether they traveled a lot or whether they grew up in a small town in northern New York. But a lot of it also is their ability to think outside their own world. And I think that's a skill that a really great journalist brings to the interview, that they are willing to go out and look and throw away their preconceived notions and think that there are people living different kinds of lives and facing different kinds of struggles than they might have faced or might not have faced at all.
But I don't think that's what... Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that's what Rex meant.
Well, I don't think I need to. Not everybody has to come from an Ivy League school. Not mm-hmm. everyone has to come from a state university system. I don't think I need to get two from here and four from there. I just need to. My newsroom is constantly changing, and as long as I keep having those voices, there's always a lack or an absence someplace, and I'm always something I'm specifically trying to fill, but it's not just one little hole. It's scattered all over the place, and who plops in there depends on a whole gamut of things.
But doesn't that leave you at some risk in that you are looking for people who fit into slots or categories, and as a result, you almost are setting up, you know, okay, I can't hire... I'm just making this up.
Like the Supreme Court, the black seat, the Jewish seat.
I can't hire another Jewish guy. I got to hire somebody who's black. I got to hire somebody who is a working class background. And that means that some people will not be hired because of their traditional upbringing.
You know, here's an example. I was recently in Houston interviewing candidates for a fellowship program that my company, the Hearst Newspaper Group, does. And we were selecting five young people from this amazing group of a dozen finalists, really bright young college journalists. And they're going to spend 2 years in our newsrooms around the country. And one of the guys who came there was a graduating from Princeton, where he had these great clips, and he had gone to Phillips Exeter, the prestigious private school. Mm-hmm. And he was so fabulous. He had done these great internships last summer at the Philadelphia Inquirer and has a New York Times summer internship coming. And we almost didn't take him. And there was actually a turning point in his interview where he said, by the way, I don't want you to think that I've just had everything handed to me. He said, you know, the only reason I've been able to do this stuff is I'm on scholarship. And he said, I went to a high school first where I was one of only four white kids in a class of 200. He said, I come from a real different background than what you may be thinking. And it actually did change our thinking about the kid. However great he was, we were inclined not to take him into the program because we thought he comes from this privileged background, the background of expectation. We thought that he wouldn't be quite the kind of candidate we wanted to bring in. But having been assured, maybe we were just assuaging our own liberal guilt or something.
Yeah, maybe.
Or, you know, saying, okay, this person's not quite like
us. I just took a shot in case you didn't hear it.
You know, but I don't have any female sports reporters, and I would love to have a female sports reporter, not because I want a woman in that department, but because I think that person may bring a whole different perspective. Maybe we would cover more women's sports, or we would give it a higher priority. But, you know, women's sports reporters are difficult to find.
That's exactly what Judy just said is really the reason you do this. It's not because you're trying to fill a slot out of some sense of getting the right numbers. It's because you just need a different perspective every now and then. I've got this great columnist at the Times Union, became a columnist just a year ago, Chris Churchill, who has a voice that comes from a background where he will tell you, you know, he grew up with food stamps, and he's a guy who is quiet and unassuming, and he doesn't look like some sophisticated newspaper columnist. But that is, and his voice is really important to be heard. So,
well, you know, it's interesting because as we speak here in Albany, New York, the state capital, we have on one of our local news channels this woman, Liz Bishop, has been here a long time and who started out as a sports reporter, very effective. And your points, both of your points about perspective is so important because apparently there was a, now I hope I have this right, quite a to-do when she first walked into the New York Yankee, you know, locker room, because as the old saying goes, towels were dropping all over the place. And so this gives you a different perspective as to what it's like to be, you know, a woman as opposed to a man in this business. I hope I'm right about that story.
Me too.
I think it was. A lot of those women who were the first women sports writers in those major league teams really had a tough go of it. You know, they were harassed. And
well, that was a form of harassment, sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union of Albany. And Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, professor, commentator, general guy with a lot to say. And that's why we opened the microphones.
And that was a shot, too.
On those rare occasions when he gets an opportunity to say something, you know, we figure that it's a good thing for him to do. You know, there's an interesting phenomenon that's developing. Apparently, people are buying newspapers again. It says here in this article that I'm seeing...
And also being cremated. More and more people are being cremated in the United States to the point where it may...
I wonder what the correlation there is.
Yes, where there may be more
newspapers
cremations than
really
burials.
Burn me up, yeah. No, that's probably not it. It's a... that's a very interesting phenomenon, Alan. Anyway, it's a smaller scale, but apparently smaller newspapers in particular, community newspapers, are considered to be a hot property, both for individual buyers and being rolled up into companies who are buying them. Warren Buffett has been doing that, and of course, nobody quite knows how that's going.
I love that guy.
Yeah, he's quite something. Halifax Media bought the 16 New York Times Company newspapers that included everything from Sarasota to a little papers in North Carolina and so on. So this is kind of an interesting notion, and we've always thought that it does seem to me that, generally speaking, the country was better off when the model of ownership was more like Judy's newspaper, a locally owned individual newspaper with the community itself owning it. You know what happened?
With somebody in the community owning it.
That's what I mean to say. Yeah. Whereas a lot of these companies, you consider Ira, who's often here, is part of a company where a lot of newspapers were rolled up through debt, and the company got into terrible trouble with debt. They bought so many papers, and suddenly they didn't have enough revenue when the bottom fell out of the market to service all the debt.
And one wonders if it isn't something like the analogy isn't something like a. grocery stores where somebody, the guy who or the woman who owns it is there and has invested their energy and their sweat equity and everything else into it, as opposed to layers of administrators who aren't quite as on top of it, in touch with it. And I think that's your point, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but one of the questions now is are the small newspapers attractive to investors because they realize they can make some money out of them? And what is the bottom line for the news product? Does this mean that they're going to invest in these newspapers and start to add pages and add staff? I mean, that's something that's not clear at this point.
Right. The difficulty is, of course, that no matter how much better the market may be getting, the inexorable trend of digitization is going forward, and it is a much more challenging revenue environment in the digital world than it was in the old print world when newspapers had virtual monopolies in their communities.
Yeah, but you know, maybe I'm just wrong about this, but I notice that in some cases, certainly, and it's not true with either of your papers, but in which some of the local papers, often rags, run by unscrupulous people sometimes, are, and I'm thinking of one in particular, around my neighborhood, they have more news. I don't know what it is, but they have more news. They can give you in-depth about what's happening at the town meeting and what's happening in the other places. And so I wonder how that
say
is.
Say that again. They're giving
you... In other words, they're giving you more stories.
Than they used
more
to.
More locals. No, the
is
local
it quantity
paper...
and the, quality or just quantity?
Well, quantity... Quality, I can't tell you too much about, because as a personal matter in this particular case, I try not to read it. But there are a lot more stories. What happened at the town meeting? What happened at this? What happened at that? They have more ease of coverage I don't quite get what allows that economic model to work. First of all, I think some of these publishers demand blood out of a stone. In other words, they really want it.
Oh, we're all in favor of that.
Yeah.
Judy and I drive our steps relentlessly.
They want a lot. From these young kids who want a job and who, you know, frankly, I think are lucky because they have to do it, but also a little exploited.
Well, I think it is true that the expectations on reporters are just impossible these days. And we, you know, it is something that people in jobs like Judy's and mine really have to think about, because there is so much that we really kind of need to do to meet all the demands of readers that it's very hard for a reporter to do it all.
So what is the one thing that really catches your eye with an employee, with a reporter? My two editors here, is it the fact that they own their job? I mean, I think that there are people who work for you, and then there are people who own the job. It's as if almost their beat becomes their own little newspaper. And if they have to go out and cover a meeting at night and be somewhere else at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's a matter of personal affront if they can't do it all. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly. That's really well put. I think that's it.
Yeah, you know, what I value most is enterprise and initiative.
Sure.
I think that everybody can hit the meeting and write the story, but what you really value is the reporter who can think outside the box and come up with a great story nobody's ever found before. And in that way, they kind of own the mission rather than the job. You know, they're just so dedicated to getting fascinating information out to readers and have them be read, that they will do that. They will go that extra mile.
You know, when you think, this goes back to our conversation about job applicants. When I have a young reporter candidate in front of me and I will say, well, why do you want to be a reporter? A lot of times what you hear is, well, I've just always loved to write. I feel like saying, well, then you should go find a job where you can write.
Or I'm a people person.
Because writing is a piece of what we do, but it's not the fundamental. I mean, what I look for are the four skills in order. First, I'm looking for intelligence. I mean, I had a mentor who used to say, reporter needs to be the smartest person in the room. That usually doesn't happen, but it's, well, except when you're covering the legislature. But it does,
except right here, right now.
But you want the person to be smart. But second, I would say, is energy. Will they go the extra mile? Do they take the time to make the extra phone call? Do they squeeze something in so that they can get the depth of a story, so we're not just in black and white, we're in the shades of gray, which is the nuance of the way we live. And our journalism has to reflect that. Third, I would say, is the curiosity. Do they really want to find that stuff? Do they have in the back of their mind what the next question is when this one's being answered? And then only fourth, I would say, are the skills, the communication skills, writing and shooting and reporting, creating the content, actually, because you can kind of teach some of that stuff, but you can't teach intelligence. They come with that. You can't teach energy.
No.
So those are the, I think, fundamental things. If there are any young reporters out there who are looking for jobs, if you lack that, and don't just say that you want to come be a writer, because newspapers, especially nowadays, there's a lot less writing than there used to be. You know, we need people who can shoot video, who can make charts. We need to get more deeply into what's the term for graphic presentation of journalism? What is that term?
We need to get into whatever the word
is. Graphic presentation of journalism.
Yes. Statistics and stuff
data visualization.
Data visualization. Thank you. There's the word. We got to do more of that. Yeah, whatever that is. Anyway, finally today, Alan, an opportunity for you in the last minute and a half here to talk to us about how is the media handling Hillary? You look at the covers of Time Magazine, the New York Times Magazine, New York Magazine. All of them are Hillary. Hillary.
Well, will she or won't she? You take a poll, she's ahead of everybody. I'm not going to give you the exact pointage because I don't really remember, but she beats the hell out of everybody. The real question on a lot of people's minds is, will she or won't she? Is she going to run? Is she going to throw everybody a curveball? In which case, it's going to energize a whole bunch of characters who we hadn't thought of, you know, like Andrew Cuomo.
Do you think
here.
The media are overdoing it, though, in the Hillary?
No, I think, you know, I've always been somebody who believes the media does what they know their readers want to hear. Now, sometimes we don't like that. Sometimes we don't like it. But in the end, a good editor, it seems to me, is in the business of, you know, being very democratic about all of this and saying, okay, if this is what they want, this is what they're going to get. And as you always point out, you know, in your sometimes, but not always, pompous way, is that...
Is he talking to you or me, Junior?
No, I want to be fair about it. I want to be
he would never say that about
I want to be fair about this. I wasn't talking to Judy. No, but you often point out that your front page has, you know, a lot of different stories on it. Whereas, as opposed to the electronic media, which has to, you know, sort of go top down.
At which point... This station has to go to its next program, and we have to get out of here, right?
Oh, we do? It's already time?
It's time.
I'm so sorry.
The Media Project, Alan Shartok, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us. See you next week. Crime and gore, ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery.